knowledge and the power of her two sisters. If we can awaken the boy and turn him to our side, we have gained ourselves an extraordinarily powerful ally. Remember the prophecy, the two that are one, the one that is all. One to save the world, one to destroy it.
And which one is the boy?
Bastet asked.
Whatever we make him,
Dee said, eyes darting from the Morrigan to Bastet and back to the Crow Goddess. Abruptly, Bastet was beside him, her huge claw around his throat. She lifted him slightly, forcing him to rise on his toes and look into her chilling eyes. For a single heartbeat, he thought about swinging the sword around, but he knew that the Cat Goddess was faster, so much faster than he would ever be. She'd see the twitch of his shoulders and simply snap his head clean off. Bastet glared at her niece.
Is it true? Are Maha and the Bab dead?
Yes, the Morrigan glared at Dee.
But I did not kill them. They died willingly and live inside me still.
For a moment, her eyes blazed yellow, then red, then solid black, the colors of the three ancient goddesses. Dee was tempted to ask how they had gotten inside her, then decided that he really didn't want to know the answer, and now probably wasn't a good time to ask anyway.
Could you awaken the boy?
Bastet demanded.
Yes. Then do it, niece,
the cat goddess ordered. She turned her attention back to Dee. Pressing her thumb under his chin, she pushed his head back.
And if you ever raise a weapon to one of the Elder Race again, I will see that you spend the next millennia in a shadow realm of my own special creation. And trust me, you will not like it.
She released her grip and flung him away, sending him sprawling in the dirt. He was still clutching the sword.
Tell me, Bastet commanded, towering over him, where are Flamel and the twins now? Where have they gone?
Dee climbed shakily to his feet. He brushed dirt off his coat and discovered yet another tear in the soft leather. He was never buying leather again. He will need to start training the girl. Hecate awakened her, but didn't get a chance to teach her any protective spells. She'll need to be taught to protect herself and control her powers before the stimuli from the physical world drive her mad.
So, where will they go?
Bastet growled. She wrapped her arms around her body and shivered. The cloud the Morrigan had summoned had grown thick and dark as it drifted lower, and now hovered just over the treetops. There was moisture in the air, and the hint of unidentifiable spices. He'll not stay in San Francisco, Dee continued. He knows we have too many agents in and around the city. The Morrigan closed her eyes and turned slowly, then she raised her arm.
They're heading south. I can just about make out the silver traces of her aura. It's incredibly powerful.
Who is the most powerful elder south of here? Dee asked quickly. Someone proficient in elemental magic?
Endor,
Bastet answered immediately.
In Ojai, the deadly witch of Endor. Mistress of the air,
the Morrigan added. Bastet leaned down, her breath foul in the small man's face.
You know where you have to go. You know what you have to do. We must have the pages of the Codex.
And the twins?
He asked tightly, trying not to breathe.
Capture them, if you can. If not, then kill them to prevent Flamel from using their powers.
Then both she and the Crow Goddess stepped into the thickening cloud and were gone. The damp grayness swirled away, leaving Dr. John Dee alone on the isolated path. How do I get to Ojai? He called. But there was no response. Dee shoved his hands in the pockets of his ruined leather coat and set off down the narrow path. He hated it when they did that, dismissed him as if he were nothing more than a child. But things would change. The elders like to think that Dee was their puppet, their tool. He had seen how Bastet had abandoned Senuhet, who had been with her for at least a century, without a second glance. He knew they would do exactly the same to him, given the chance. But Dr. John Dee had plans to ensure that they never got that chance.
Chapter 33. It was late in the afternoon when Josh finally turned the Hummer down the long, curving road that led into the small city of Ojai. The stress of driving 400 miles in one long trip was etched onto his face, and although the computer had estimated that it would take around 6.5 hours, it had taken close to 9. Driving the big Hummer on the highway was surprisingly easy. He'd simply put on the cruise control and let it go. It was boring, but off the highway, and on any other type of road, the Hummer was a nightmare to control. It wasn't like any of his computer games. It was just so big, and he was terrified he was going to run over something. The huge jet-black vehicle also attracted a lot of attention. He'd never thought he'd be so happy to have tinted windows. He wondered what people would think if they knew it was being driven by a 15-year-old. The road curved to the right, and Ojai's long, straight main street appeared before him. He slowed as he passed the Psychic Boutique and the Ojai Playhouse. Then the lights changed at Signal Street, and he stopped, leaned across the steering wheel, and peered through the smeared, bug-spattered windshield. His first impression as he looked down the empty street was that Ojai was surprisingly green. It was June in California, that time of year when most things had turned brown and withered, but here there were trees everywhere, contrasting with the white stone of the buildings. Directly in front of him, to his right, a low, ornate white stone tower rose over the post office into the brilliant blue sky, while on the left, a row of shops was set back from the road, sheltered beneath a row of white stone arches. Glancing in the rearview mirror, he was surprised to find Scatty's eyes on him. "I thought you were asleep," he said quietly. Sophie, who had moved up into the passenger seat beside him after a few hours of driving, lay curled up asleep, and Flamel snored gently beside Scatty.
"I've no need to sleep," she said simply.
There were a lot of questions he really wanted to ask, but instead he just said, "Do you know where we're going?" She leaned forward, rested her arms on the back of his seat and her chin on her arms.
"Straight on, past the post office, that's the building with the tower, then turn right after Libby Park at Fox Street. Find a parking space down there."
She nodded to the left toward a row of shops nestled under the white arches.
"We are going there."
"Is that where your grandmother is?"
"Yes,"
Scatty said shortly.
"And is she really a witch?" "Not just a witch. She is the original witch."
"How do you feel?"
Sophie asked. She stood on the sidewalk and stretched, standing on her toes and arching her back. Something popped in her neck.
"That feels good,"
she added, turning her face and closing her eyes against the sun, which was still high in the cloudless robin's egg blue heavens.
"I should be asking you that question," Josh said, climbing out of the car.
He yawned and stretched, rotating his head from side to side.
"I never want to drive again," he added.
His voice dropped to a little more than a whisper.
"I'm glad you're okay,"
he hesitated.
"You are okay, aren't you?"
Sophie reached out to squeeze her brother's arm.
"I think so."
Flamel climbed out of the car and slammed his door. Scatty had already moved away from the car to stand beneath the shelter of a tree. She dug a pair of mirrored sunglasses from her pocket and popped them onto her face. The alchemist went to join her as Josh hit the alarm on the keychain. The car blipped once and its lights flashed.
"We need to talk," Flamel said quietly, though the side street was deserted.
He ran his fingers through his close-cropped hair, and strands came away on his fingers. He looked at them for a moment, then brushed them on his jeans. Another year was etched onto his face, subtly deepening the lines around his eyes and the semicircular grooves on either side of his mouth.
"This person we're going to see can be," he hesitated and then said, "difficult."
"You're telling me," Scatty muttered.
"What do you mean, difficult?" Josh asked in alarm. After everything they had just encountered, difficult could mean just about anything.
"Cranky, cantankerous, irritable. And that's when she's in a good mood, Scatty said. And when she's in a bad mood? You don't even want to be in the same city as her.
Josh was puzzled. He turned to the alchemist. Then why are we going to see her?
Because Perna told me to, he said patiently. Because she is the mistress of air, and can teach Sophie the basics of elemental air magic, and because she can give Sophie some advice on how to protect herself.
From what?
Josh asked, startled.
From herself,
Flamel said, matter-of-factly, and turned away, heading back toward Ojai Avenue. Scatty moved out of the shadows and fell into step beside him.
Wish I'd brought sunscreen. I burn easily in the sunshine, she grumbled as they walked away. And wait till you see my freckles in the morning.
Josh turned back to his sister. He was beginning to have some idea of the huge gulf of understanding that now separated him from his twin.
Do you have any idea what he was talking about? Protecting yourself from yourself? What's that supposed to mean?
I think I know, Sophie frowned. Everything around me is so loud, so bright, so sharp, so intense. It's like someone turned the volume up. My senses are so acute, you wouldn't believe what I can hear.
She pointed to a battered red Toyota driving slowly down the road.
The woman in that car is talking on the phone to her mother. She's telling her she doesn't want fish for dinner.
She pointed to a truck parked in a yard on the opposite side of the street.
There's a sticker on the back of the truck. Do you want me to tell you what it says?
Josh squinted. He couldn't even read the license plate.
When we ate earlier today, the taste of the food was so overwhelming it almost made me throw up. I could taste the individual grains of salt on the sandwich.
She stooped and picked a jacaranda leaf off the ground.
I can trace each vein in the back of this leaf with my eyes closed. But you know what's worst of all? The smells,
she said, looking deliberately at her brother. Hey. Ever since he'd hit puberty, he'd tried every deodorant on the market.
No, not just you, she grinned. Though you've really got to change your deodorant, and I think you're going to need to burn your socks. It's all the scents, all the time. The stink of gas in the air is awful. The smell of hot rubber on the road, of greasy food, even the perfume from these flowers is overwhelming.
She stopped in the middle of the street, and her tone abruptly changed. She looked at her brother, and the tears she had no idea were there started to leak from her eyes.
It's too much, Josh. It's just too much. I feel sick, and my head is pounding. My eyes hurt, my ears ache, my throat is raw.
Josh awkwardly tried to put his arms around his sister to hug her, but she pushed him away.
Please, don't touch me. I can't bear it.
Josh struggled to find words to respond, but there was nothing he could say or do. He felt so helpless. Sophie was always so strong, always in control. She was the person he went to when he was in trouble. She always had the answers. Until now.
Flamel.
Josh felt the anger flare again. This was Flamel's fault. He would never forgive the alchemist for what he'd done. He looked up to see Flamel and Skatok turning back to them. The warrior came hurrying over to them.
Dry your eyes, she commanded sternly. Let's not draw attention to ourselves. Don't talk to my sis...
Josh began, but Scatty silenced him with a look.
Let's get you into my grandmother's shop. She'll be able to help. It's just across the road. Come on.
Sophie obediently ran her sleeve across her eyes and followed the warrior. She felt so helpless. She rarely cried. She'd even laughed at the ending of Titanic. So why was she crying now? Awakening her magical potential had seemed like a wonderful idea. She loved the thought of being able to control and shape her will, of channeling her aura's energy and working magic. But it hadn't turned out like that. It had left her feeling battered and exhausted from the stimulation. It had left her in pain. That was why she was crying. And she was terrified that the pain was not going to go away. And if it didn't, then what would she do? What could she do? Sophie looked up to find her brother staring hard at her, eyes wide with concern.
Flamel said the witch will be able to help you, he said. What if she can't, Josh? What if she can't?
He had no answer to that. Sophie and Josh crossed Ojai Avenue
and stepped under the arched promenade that ran the length of the block. The temperature immediately dropped to a bearable level, and Sophie realized that her shirt was sticking to the small of her back, ice cold against her spine. They caught up with Nicholas Flamel, who had stopped in front of a small antiques shop, a dismayed look on his face. The shop was closed. Without saying a word, he tapped at the paper clock taped to the inside of the door. The hands were set to 2:30, and a handwritten scrawl beneath it said, "Gone to lunch, back at 2:30. It was now close to 3:30. Flamel and Scatty leaned against the door, peering inside, while the twins looked through the window. The small shop seemed to sell only glassware, bowls, jugs, plates, paperweights, ornaments, and mirrors. Lots of mirrors. They were everywhere, and in all shapes and sizes, from tiny circles to huge rectangles. Much of the glass looked modern, but a few of the pieces in the window were obviously antiques. "So, what do we do now?" Flamel wondered. "Where can she be?" "Probably wandered out to get lunch and forgot to come back," Scatty said, turning to look up and down the street. "Hardly busy today, is it?" Even though it was late Friday afternoon, traffic was light on the main street, and there were fewer than a dozen pedestrians moving slowly beneath the covered promenade.
"We could check the restaurants," Flamel suggested. "What does she like to eat?"
"Don't ask," Scatty said quickly. "You really do not want to know."
"Maybe if we split up," Nicholas began.
On impulse, Sophie leaned forward and turned the handle. A bell jangled musically, and the door swung open.
"Nice one, sis."
"Saw it done in a movie once," she muttered. "Hello?" she called, stepping into the shop. There was no response. The antiques shop was tiny, little more than a long rectangular room, but the effect of the hundreds of mirrors, some of which even dangled from the ceiling, made it look much bigger than it actually was. Sophie threw back her head and breathed deeply, nostrils flaring.
"Do you smell that?"
Her twin shook his head. The number of mirrors was making him nervous. He kept catching reflections of himself from all sides, and in every mirror his image was different, broken or distorted.
"What do you smell?"
Scatty asked.
"It's like," Sophie paused, "like wood smoke in the fall."
"So, she has been here." Sophie and Josh looked at her blankly.
"That's the odor of the Witch of Endor. That's the scent of eldritch magic."
Flamel stood by the door, looking up and down the street. "She can't have gone far if she left the shop unlocked. I'm going to go look for her." He turned to Scatty.
"How will I recognize her?"
She grinned, eyes bright and wicked.
"Trust me. You'll know her when you see her."
"I'll be back shortly."
As Flamel stepped out into the street, a big motorcycle pulled up almost directly outside the shop. The rider sat there for a moment and then gunned his engine and roared away. The noise was incredible. All the glassware in the tiny shop shivered and vibrated with the sound. Sophie pressed both hands to her ears.
"I don't know how much more of this I can take," she whispered tearfully.
Josh led his sister to a plain wooden chair and made her sit down. He crouched on one side, wanting to hold her hand, but frightened of touching her. He felt utterly useless. Scatty knelt down directly in front of Sophie, so that their faces were level.
"When Hecate awakened you, she didn't have a chance to teach you how to turn your awakened senses on and off. Your senses are stuck on at the moment, but it won't be like that all the time, I promise you. With a little training and a few basic protective spells, you'll learn to turn your senses on for just the briefest of periods."
Josh looked at the two girls. Once again, he felt apart from his twin. Truly apart. They were fraternal twins, and therefore not genetically identical. They didn't share those feelings that identical twins often spoke about, feeling pain when the other twin was hurt, knowing when they were in trouble. But right now, he could feel his sister's distress. He only wished there was something he could do to ease her pain. Almost as if she could read his mind, Scatty said suddenly,
"There is something I can do that might help."
The twins picked up on the note of hesitation in her voice.
"It will not hurt," she added quickly.
It can't hurt more than what I'm feeling now,
Sophie whispered.
Do it,
she said quickly.
I need your permission first.
Soph,
Josh began, but his sister ignored him.
Do it,
Sophie repeated.
Please,
she begged.
I've told you, I am what you Himani call a vampire.
You are not drinking her blood, Josh yelled, horrified. His stomach flipped over at the thought.
I've told you before, my clan do not drink blood.
I don't care. Josh, Sophie interrupted angrily, her aura winking into existence for a second with her anger, filling the interior of the shop with the sudden sweetness of vanilla ice cream. A display of glass wind chimes tinkled and rattled in an unfelt breeze.
Josh, be quiet.
She swiveled in the seat to look at Scatty.
What do you want me to do? Give me your right hand.
Sophie immediately stretched out her hand, and Scatty took it in both of hers. Then she carefully matched the fingers of her left hand to the girl's fingers, thumb to thumb, index finger to index finger, little finger to little finger.
Blood-drinking vampires,
she said absently, concentrating on aligning their hands,
are really the weakest, the lowliest of our clan. Have you ever wondered why they drink blood? They're actually dead. Their hearts do not beat. They have no need to eat, so the blood provides no sustenance for them.
Are you dead?
Sophie asked the question Josh was just about to ask.
No, not really.
Josh looked into the mirrors, but he could clearly see Skatok's reflection in the glass. She caught him looking and smiled.
Don't believe that old rubbish about vampires not casting a reflection. Of course we do. We are solid, after all.
Josh watched intently as Skatok pressed her fingers to his sister's. Nothing seemed to be happening. Then he caught a sparkle of silver in a mirror behind Scatty, and he realized that in the glass, Sophie's hand had begun to glow with a pale, silver light.
My race, the clan vampire,
Scatty continued very softly, staring at Sophie's palm.
We're of the next generation.
In the mirror, Josh saw that the silver light had begun to pool in Sophie's palm.
We were not elders. All of us who were born after the fall of Danu Talis were completely unlike our parents. We were different in incomprehensible ways.
You've mentioned Danu Talis before,
Sophie murmured sleepily.
What is it? A place?
There was a warm, soothing feeling flowing up her arm, not unlike pins and needles, but tingling and pleasant.
It was the center of the world in the Elder times. The Elder race ruled this planet from an island continent known as Danu Talis. It stretched from what is now the coast of Africa to the shores of North America and into the Gulf of Mexico.
I've never heard of Danu Talis,
Sophie whispered.
Yes, you have, Skatok said. The Celts called it the Danann Isle. This modern world knows it as Atlantis.
In the mirror, Josh could see that Sophie's hand was now glowing silver white. It looked as if she were wearing a glove. Tiny sparking tendrils of silver wrapped themselves around Scatty's fingers like ornate rings, and she shuddered.
Danu Talis was ripped apart because the ruling twins, the Sun and Moon, fought on top of the Great Pyramid. The incredible magical forces they released upset the balance of nature. I've been told that the same wild magic swirling around the atmosphere caused the changes in the next generation. Some of us were born as monsters, others were caught between shapes. A few possessed extraordinary powers of transformation and could become beasts at will. And others, like those of us who eventually formed the clan vampire, found that we were unable to feel.
Josh looked sharply at Skatok.
What do you mean, feel?
The warrior smiled and looked at him. Suddenly, her teeth seemed very long in her mouth.
We had little or no emotion. We lacked the capacity to feel fear, to experience love, to enjoy the sensations of happiness and delight. The finest warriors are not only those who do not know fear, but those who are without anger.
Josh stepped back from Scatty and breathed deeply. His legs were beginning to cramp, and pins and needles were tingling in his toes. But he also needed to get away from the vampire. Now, all the mirrors and polished glass surfaces in the shop showed the silver light flowing from Sophie's hand up Scatty's arm. It disappeared into her flesh before it reached her elbow. Scatty turned her head to look at Josh, and he noticed that the whites of her eyes had turned silver.
Blood-sucking vampires don't need the blood. They need the emotions, the sensations carried in the blood. You're stealing Sophie's feelings, Josh whispered, horrified. Sophie, stop her. No,
his twin snapped, eyes opening wide. The whites of her eyes, like Scatty's, had turned reflective silver.
I can actually feel the pain flowing away. The sensations are too much for your sister to bear. They are becoming painful, and this makes her afraid. I'm just taking away that pain and fear.
Why would anyone want to feel pain or fear? Josh wondered aloud, both intrigued and repelled by the very idea. It seemed somehow wrong.
So they can feel alive, Scatty said.
Chapter 34. Even before she opened her eyes, Perronel Flamel knew she had been moved to a much more secure prison, someplace deep and dark and sinister. She could feel the old evil in the walls, could almost taste it on the air. Lying still, she tried to expand her senses, but the blanket of malevolence and despair was too strong, and she found she couldn't use her magic. She listened intently, and only when she was absolutely sure that there was no one in the room with her did she open her eyes. She was in a cell. Three walls were solid concrete. The fourth was metal bars. Beyond the bars, she could see another row of cells. She was in a prison block. Perronel swung her legs out of the narrow cot and came slowly to her feet. She noticed that her clothes smelled slightly of sea salt, and she thought she could detect the sounds of the not-too-distant ocean. The cell was bare, little more than an empty box, about 10 feet long by 4 feet wide, with a narrow cot holding a thin mattress and a single lumpy pillow. A cardboard tray lay on the floor just inside the bars. It contained a plastic jug of water, a plastic cup, and a thick chunk of dark bread on a paper plate. Seeing the food made her realize just how hungry she was, but she ignored it for the moment and crossed to the bars and peered out. Looking left and right, all she could see were cells, and they were empty. She was alone in the cell block, but where? And then a ship's horn, plaintive and lost, sounded in the distance. With a shiver, Perronel suddenly knew where Dee's men had taken her. She was on the prison island of Alcatraz, the Rock. She looked around the room, paying particular attention to the area around the metal gate. Unlike in her previous prison, she couldn't see any magical wards or protective sigils painted on the lintel or the floor. Perronel couldn't resist a tiny smile. What were Dee's people thinking? Once she had recovered her strength, she'd charge up her aura and then bend this metal like putty and simply walk out of here. It took her a moment before she realized that the click-click she'd first assumed to be dripping water was actually something approaching, moving slowly and deliberately. Pressing herself against the bars, she tried to see down the corridor. A shadow moved. More of Dee's faceless simulacra? She wondered. They would not be able to hold her for long. The shadow, huge and misshapen, moved out of the darkness and stepped down the corridor to stand before her cell. Perronel was suddenly grateful for the bars that separated her from the terrifying entity. Filling the corridor was a creature that had not walked the earth since a millennium before the first pyramid rose over the Nile. It was a sphinx, an enormous lion with the wings of an eagle and the head of a beautiful woman. The sphinx smiled and tilted her head to one side, and a long black forked tongue flickered. Perronel noticed that her pupils were flat and horizontal. This was not one of Dee's creations. The sphinx was one of the daughters of Echidna, one of the foulest of the elders, shunned and feared even by her own race, even the Dark Elders. Perronel suddenly found herself wondering who exactly Dee was serving. The sphinx pressed her face against the bars. Her long tongue shot out, tasting the air, almost brushing Perronel's lips.
"Do I need to remind you, Perronel Flamel?"
she asked, in the language of the Nile.
that one of the especial skills of my race is that we absorb auric energy.
Her huge wings flapped, almost filling the corridor.
You have no magical powers around me.
An icy shiver ran down Perrineau's spine as she realized just how clever Dee was. She was a defenseless and powerless prisoner on Alcatraz, and she knew that no one had ever escaped the rock alive. Chapter 35. The bell jangled as Nicholas Flamel pushed open the door and stepped back to allow a rather ordinary-looking elderly woman in a neat gray blouse and gray skirt to precede him into the shop. Short and round, her hair tightly permed and touched faintly with blue, only the overlarge black glasses covering much of her face set her apart. A white cane was folded in her right hand. Sophie and Josh immediately realized that she was blind. Flamel cleared his throat.
"Allow me to introduce."
He stopped and looked at the woman.
"Excuse me. What do I call you?"
"Call me Dora. Everyone else does."
She spoke English with a decided New York accent.
"Scathawk?"
she suddenly said.
"Scathawk!"
And then her words dissolved into a language that seemed to consist of a lot of spitting sounds, which Sophie was surprised to find she could understand.
"She wants to know why Scatty hasn't come to see her in the past 372 years, 8 months, and 4 days,"
she translated for Josh. She was staring intently at the old woman and didn't see the fear and envy that flickered across his face. The old woman moved quickly around the narrow room, head darting left and right, never looking directly at Scatty. She continued to speak, seemingly without stopping for breath.
"She's telling Scatty that she could have been dead and no one would have known, nor cared. Why, only last century she was desperately ill, and no one called, no one wrote."
"Gran,"
Scatty began.
"Don't gran me,"
Dora said, dropping into English again.
"You could have written, any language would have done, you could have phoned."
"You don't have a phone."
"And what's wrong with email? Or a fax?"
"Gran, had you got a computer, or a fax machine?"
Dora stopped.
"Now, what would I need one of them for?"
Dora's hand moved, and suddenly her white stick extended to its full length with a snap. She tapped against the glass of a simple square mirror.
"Have you got one of these?"
"Yes, Gran,"
Scatty said miserably. Her pale cheeks were flushed red with embarrassment.
"So, you couldn't find the time to look in the mirror and talk to me? You're so busy these days. I've got to hear it from your brother. And when was the last time you spoke to your mother?"
Scathawk turned to the twins.
"This is my grandmother, the legendary witch of Andor. Gran, this is Sophie and Josh. And you've met Nicholas Flamel."
"Yes, such a nice man."
She kept turning her head, her nostrils flaring.
"Twins,"
she said finally. Sophie and Josh looked at each other. How did she know? Did Nicholas tell her? There was something about the way the woman kept moving her head that intrigued Josh. He tried to follow the direction of her gaze, and then he realized why the old woman's head kept moving left and right. She was somehow seeing them through the mirrors. Automatically, he touched his sister's hand and nodded to the mirror. She glanced at it, back at the old woman, then back at the mirror, and then she nodded at her brother, silently agreeing with him. Dora stepped up to Scathawk. Her head turned to one side as she stared hard at a tall length of polished glass.
"You've lost weight. Are you eating properly?"
"Gran, I've looked like this for 2,500 years.
"So you're saying I'm going blind now, eh?"
the old woman asked, then burst into surprisingly deep laughter.
"Give your old gran a hug."
Scathawk carefully hugged the old woman and kissed her cheek.
"It's good to see you, Gran. You're looking well."
"I'm looking old."
"Do I look old?" "Not a day over 10,000,
Scatty smiled. The witch pinched Scathawk's cheek.
"The last person who mocked me was a tax inspector. I turned him into a paperweight," she said. "I still have it here somewhere."
Flamel coughed discreetly.
Madam Ender.
Call me Dora,
the old woman snapped.
Dora, are you aware what happened in Hecate's Shadow Realm earlier today?
He had never met the witch before. He knew her only by reputation, but he knew she needed to be treated with the utmost caution. She was the legendary elder who had left Danu Talis to live with and teach the Humani centuries before the island sank beneath the waves. It was believed that she had created the first Humani alphabet in ancient Sumeria.
Get me a chair,
Dora said to no one in particular. Sophie pulled up the chair she'd been sitting on, and Scatty eased her grandmother into it. The old woman leaned forward, both hands resting on the top of her white cane.
I know what happened. I'm sure every elder on this continent felt her death.
She saw their looks of shock surprise.
You didn't know?
She turned her head sideways and stared into a mirror, directly facing Scatty.
Hecate is dead, and her shadow realm is no more.
I understand an elder, one of the next generation, and an immortal human were responsible for her death. Hecate will need to be avenged. Not now, and maybe not soon. But she was family, and I owe her that.
See to it.
Scatty bowed. The Witch of Endor had delivered the death sentence calmly, and Flamel suddenly realized that this woman was even more dangerous than he had imagined. Dora turned her face in another direction, and Flamel found himself looking at her reflection in an ornate silver-framed mirror. She tapped the glass.
I saw what happened this morning a month ago.
And you didn't warn Hecate,
Scatty exclaimed.
I watched one thread of a possible future. One of many. In some of the others, Hecate killed Bastet and the Morrigan slew Dee. In another, Hecate killed you, Mr. Flamel, and was in turn killed by Skatok. All versions of the future. Today, I discovered which came to pass.
She looked around the room, turning her face from mirror to polished vase to picture frame glass.
So, I know why you're here, I know what you want me to do, and I've thought long and hard about my response. I've had a month to think about it.
What about us?
Sophie asked.
Were we in your threads?
Yes, in some,
the witch said.
What happened to us and the others?
The question was out of Josh's mouth before he had time to think about it. He really didn't want to know the answer.
Dee and his golems, or the rats and birds, killed you in most of the threads. You crashed the car in others. You died with the Awakening or fell with the Shadow Realm.
Josh swallowed hard.
We only survived in one thread?
Just one.
That's not good, is it?
He whispered.
Now,
the Witch of Endor stated flatly,
not good at all.
There was a long pause while Dora looked sidelong into the polished surface of a silver pot. Then she spoke suddenly.
First you should know that I cannot awaken the boy. That must be left to others.
Josh looked up quickly.
There are others who could awaken me?
The Witch of Endor ignored him.
The girl has one of the purest silver auras I've encountered in many an age. She needs to be taught some spells of personal protection if she is to survive the rest of the awakening process. The fact that she's still sane in a hole these many hours later is testament to her strength of will.
Her head tilted back, and Sophie caught the old woman's face looking at her from a mirror suspended from the ceiling.
This I will do.
Thank you,
Nicholas Flamel said with a deep sigh. I know how difficult the last few hours have been for her. Josh found that he could not look at his sister.
There was more to the awakening. Did that mean she would have to suffer more pain? It was heartbreaking.
Skatok knelt by her grandmother's chair and laid a hand on her arm.
Gran, Dee and his masters are chasing the two missing pages from the Codex, she said. I would imagine that by now they know, or at least suspect, that Sophie and Josh are the twins mentioned in the Book of Abraham.
Dora nodded.
Dee knows.
Skatok stole a glance at Flamel.
Then he knows that not only does he have to retrieve the pages, but he has to either capture or kill the twins.
He knows that too,
Dora confirmed.
And if Dee succeeds, then this world ends?
Skatok said, turning the simple sentence into a question.
The world has ended before, the witch answered, smiling. I'm sure it will end many times before the sun turns black.
You know that Dee intends to bring back the Dark Elders.
I know.
The Codex says that the Dark Elders can only be stopped by silver and gold,
Scatty continued.
The Codex also says, if my memory serves me true, that apples are poisonous and frogs can turn into princes. You don't want to believe everything you read in that Codex,
the witch snapped. Flamel had read the piece in the Codex about apples. He thought it was possibly referring to apple seeds, which were indeed poisonous, if you ate several pounds of them. He hadn't come across the section about frogs and princes, though he'd read the book hundreds of times. There were countless questions he wanted to ask the witch, but that wasn't the reason they were there.
Dora, will you teach Sophie the principles of air magic? She needs to learn enough to at least be able to protect herself from attack.
Dora shrugged and smiled.
Do I have a choice?
Flamel had not been expecting that answer.
Of course you have a choice.
The Witch of Endor shook her head.
Not this time.
She reached up and took off her dark glasses. Scatty didn't move, and only the muscle twitching in Flamel's jaw betrayed his surprise. The twins, however, backed away in horror, their faces registering their shock. The Witch of Endor had no eyes. There were just hollow, empty sockets where eyes should have been, and nestled in the sockets were perfect ovals of reflective glass. Those mirrors turned directly to the twins.
I gave up my eyes for the sight. The ability to see the patterns of time. Time past, present, and possible future. There are many patterns, many versions of possible future, though not so many as people think. In the past few years, the patterns have been coming together, weaving ever closer. Now there are only a few possible futures. Most of them are terrifying, she added grimly, and they are all linked to you two.
Her hand moved unswervingly to point to Sophie and Josh.
So what choice do I have? This is my world, too. I was here before the Humani. I gave them fire and language. I'll not abandon them now. I'll train the girl, teach her how to protect herself, and instill in her how to control the magic of air.
Thank you,
Sophie said carefully into the long silence that followed.
Do not thank me. This is not a gift. What I give you is a curse.
Chapter 36 Josh stepped out of the antiques shop, cheeks flaming red, the witch's last words ringing in his ears.
You have to leave. What I teach is not for the ears of a Humani.
Looking around the room at Flamel and Scatty, and finally his twin sister, Josh had suddenly realized that he was the last pure human in the room. Obviously, in the Witch of Endor's eyes, Sophie was no longer entirely human.
No problem. I'll wait,
he began, voice suddenly cracking. He coughed and tried again.
I'll wait in the park across the road.
And then, without a backward glance, he left the shop, the jangling of the bell mocking him as he closed the door. But it was a problem. A huge problem. Sophie Newman watched her brother leave the shop, and even without her awakened senses, she knew he was upset and angry. She wanted to stop him, to go after him, but Scatty was standing in front of her, eyes wide in warning, finger raised to her lips, the tiniest shake of her head warning Sophie to say nothing. Catching her shoulder, Scatty led her to stand in front of the Witch of Endor. The old woman raised her hands and ran surprisingly gentle fingers over the contours of Sophie's face. The girl's aura shivered and fizzed with each gentle touch.
How old are you now?
She asked.
15? Well, 15 and a half.
Sophie wasn't sure if the half year made a difference.
15 and a half, Dora said, shaking her head. I can't remember back that far.
She dipped her chin, then tilted it towards Scatty.
Can you remember back to when you were 15?
Vividly,
Skatok said grimly.
Wasn't that about the time I visited you in Babylon, and you tried to marry me off to King Nebuchadnezzar?
I'm sure you're wrong, Dora said happily. I think that was later. Though he would have made an excellent husband, she added.
She looked up at Sophie, and the girl found herself reflected in the mirrors that were the witch's eyes.
There are two things I must teach you. To protect yourself, that is simplicity itself. But instructing you in the magic of air is a little trickier. The last time I instructed a Humani in air magic, it took him 60 years to master the basics. And even then, he fell out of the sky in his first flight.
60 years, Sophie swallowed. Did that mean she was destined to spend a lifetime trying to control this power?
Gran, we haven't got that sort of time. I doubt we've even got 60 minutes.
Dora glared into a mirror, and her reflection looked out from the glass of an empty picture frame.
So why don't you do this? You're such an expert, eh?
Gran,
Skatok sighed.
Don't gran me in that tone of voice, Dora said warningly. I'll do this my way.
We don't have time to do it in the traditional way.
Don't talk to me about tradition. What do the young know about tradition? Trust me, when I'm finished, Sophie will know all that I know about the elemental air magic.
She turned back to Sophie.
First things first. Are your parents alive?
Yes, she said, blinking in surprise, not sure where this was going.
Good. And you talk to your mother?
Yes, almost every day. Dora glanced sideways at Scatty.
You hear that? Almost every day.
She took one of Sophie's hands in hers and patted the back of it.
Maybe you should be teaching Skatok a thing or two.
And have you a grandmother?
My Nana, yes, my father's mother. I usually call her on Fridays, she added, realizing with a guilty start that today was Friday and that Nana Newman would be expecting a call.
Every Friday,
the Witch of Endor said significantly, and looked at Scatty again. But the warrior deliberately turned away and concentrated on an ornate glass paperweight. She put it down when she saw that there was a tiny man in a 3-piece suit frozen inside the glass. He had a briefcase in one hand and a sheaf of papers in the other. His eyes were still blinking.
This will not hurt, the witch said.
Sophie doubted it could be any worse than what she'd already gone through. Her nose wrinkled at the odor of burnt wood, and she felt a cool breeze wash over her hands. She looked down. A gossamer-thin white spiderweb was twisting and spinning from the Witch of Endor's fingers and wrapping itself like a bandage around each of Sophie's fingers. It curled across her palm, completely covering it, then wrapped around her wrist and crept up her arm. She realized then that the witch had been distracting her with her questions. Sophie looked into the witch's mirrored eyes and found that she could not put her questions into words. It was as if she had lost the ability to speak. She was also surprised that instead of feeling frightened, from the moment the witch had taken her hand, a wave of peace and calm had washed through her body. She glanced sideways at Scatty and Flamel. They were watching the process wide-eyed with shock and, in Skatok's case, with something like horror on her face.
Gran, are you sure about this?
Skatok demanded.
Of course I'm sure,
the old woman snapped, a note of anger in her voice. And even though the Witch of Endor was speaking to Skatok, Sophie could hear her voice in her head, talking to her, whispering ancient secrets, murmuring archaic spells, divulging a lifetime of knowledge in the space of heartbeats and breaths.
This is not a spider web,
Dora explained to a stunned and silent Flamel, noticing that he was leaning forward, staring intently at the webs spinning around Sophie's arms.
It is concentrated air mixed with my own aura. All my knowledge, my experience, even my lore, is gathered in this web of air. Once it touches Sophie's skin, she will begin to absorb that knowledge.
Sophie breathed deeply, drawing the wood-scented air deep into her lungs. Images flashed impossibly fast in her head, times and places long past. Cyclopean walls of stone, ships of solid gold, dinosaurs and dragons, a city carved into a mountain of ice, and faces, hundreds, thousands of faces,
from every race of mankind, from every time period, human and half-human, werebeast and monster. She was seeing everyone the Witch of Endor had ever seen.
"The Egyptians got it wrong," Dora continued, her hands now moving too fast for Flamel to see. "They wrapped the dead," she continued. "They did not realize I wrapped the living. There was a time when I put a little of myself into my followers and sent them out into the world to teach in my name. Obviously, someone saw this process in the ancient past and tried to copy it."
Sophie suddenly saw a dozen people wrapped up like her, and a younger-looking Dora moving among them, dressed in a costume from ancient Babylon. Somehow Sophie understood that these were the priests and priestesses in the cult that worshipped the witch. Dora was passing on a little of her knowledge to them, so that they could go out into the world and teach others. The white web-like air now flowed down Sophie's legs, binding them together. Unconsciously, she brought her hands up across her chest, right hand on her left shoulder, left hand on her right shoulder. The witch nodded approvingly. Sophie closed her eyes and saw clouds. Without knowing how, she knew their names. Cirrus, Cirrocumulus, Altostratus, and Stratocumulus, Nimbostratus, and Cumulus. All different, each type with unique characteristics and qualities. She suddenly understood how to use them, how to shape and wield and move them. Images flickered, flashed. She saw a tiny woman under a clear blue sky raise a hand and make a cloud grow directly overhead. Rain irrigated a parched field. Flashed again. A tall bearded man standing on the edge of a huge sea raised his hands, and a howling wind parting the waters. And flashed again. A young woman brought a raging storm to a shuddering stop with a single gesture, freezing it in place, then ran into a flimsy wooden house and grabbed a child. A heartbeat later, and the storm ate the house. Sophie watched the images and learned from them. The Witch of Endor touched Sophie's cheek, and the girl opened her eyes. The whites were dotted with silver sparkles.
"There are those who will tell you that the magic of fire, or water, or even earth, is the most powerful magic of all. They are wrong. The magic of air surpasses all others. Air can extinguish fire. It can churn water to mist and can rip up the earth. But air can also bring fire to life. It can push a boat across still water, can shape the land. Air can clean a wound, can pluck a splinter from a fingertip. Air can kill."
The last of the white cobwebbed air closed across Sophie's face, completely encasing her, wrapping her like a mummy.
"This is a terrifying gift I have given you. Within you now is a lifetime, a very long lifetime of experience. I hope some will be of use to you in the dire days ahead."
Sophie stood before the Witch of Endor, completely encased in the white, bandage-like air. This was not like the awakening. This was a gentler, subtler process. She discovered that she knew things, incredible things. She had memories of impossible times and extraordinary places. But mixed with these memories and emotions were her own thoughts. Already, she was beginning to find it hard to tell them apart. Then the smoke began to curl and hiss and steam. Dora suddenly turned to look for Scatty.
"Come and give me a hug, child. I will not see you again."
"Gran?"
Dora wrapped her arms around Skatok's shoulders and put her mouth close to her ear. Her voice dropped to little more than a whisper.
"I have given this girl a rare and terrible power. Make sure this power is used for good."
Skatok nodded, not entirely sure what the old woman was suggesting.
"And call your mother. She worries about you."
"I will, Gran."
The mummy-like cocoon suddenly dissolved into steam and mist as Sophie's aura flared brilliant silver. She stretched out her arms, fingers splayed wide, and the merest whisper of a wind rattled through the shop.
"Careful. If you break anything, you pay for it.
the witch warned. Then, suddenly, Skatok, Dora, and Sophie turned to look out into the darkening afternoon. An instant later, Nicholas Flamel smelled the unmistakable rotten egg odor of sulfur. D. Josh! Sophie's eyes snapped open. Josh is out there.
Chapter 37. Dr. John D. finally arrived in Ojai as the last light was fading in spectacular shades of pink over the surrounding Topa Topa Mountains. He'd been traveling all day. He was tired and irritable and looking for an excuse to hurt someone. Hecate's Shadow Realm had drained his cell battery, and it had taken him over an hour before he could find a phone to contact his office. He'd then been forced to sit, fuming, by the side of the road for another 90 minutes while a team of drivers scoured Mill Valley's back roads looking for him. It was close to 9:30 before he finally returned to his office at Enoch Enterprises in the heart of the city. There, he'd learned that Perenelle had already been moved to Alcatraz. His company had recently purchased the island from the state and had closed it to the public while restoration work was being carried out. There was talk in the papers that it was going to be turned into a living history museum. In reality, the doctor intended to return it to its original use as one of the most secure prisons in the world. The doctor briefly thought about flying out to the island to talk to Perenelle, but dismissed the idea as a waste of time. The missing pages from the Codex and the twins were his priorities. Although Bastet had said to kill them if he couldn't kidnap them, Dee had other ideas. Dee knew of the famous prophecy from the Book of Abraham the Mage. The elders had known the twins were coming. The two that are one, the one that is all. One to save the world, one to destroy it. But which one was which, he wondered. And could their powers be shaped and twisted by the instruction they received? Finding the boy was becoming as important as finding the missing pages of the Codex. He had to have that gold aura. Dr. John Dee had lived in Ojai briefly at the turn of the 20th century. It was still called the city of Nordhoff then, when he'd been plundering the surrounding Chumash burial grounds for their precious artifacts. He'd hated it. Ojai was too small, too insular, and, in the summer months, simply too hot for him. Dee was always happiest in the largest of cities, where it was easier to be invisible and anonymous. He'd flown from San Francisco down to Santa Barbara in the company helicopter and rented a nondescript-looking Ford at the small airport. Then he'd driven down from Santa Barbara, arriving in Ojai just as the sun was setting in a spectacular display, painting the town in long, elegant shadows. Ojai had changed dramatically in the 100 or so years since he'd last seen it, but he still didn't like it. He turned the car onto Ojai Avenue and slowed. Flamel and the others were close, he could feel it, but he had to be careful now. If he could sense them, then they, especially the alchemist and Skatok, would be able to sense him. And he still had no idea what the Witch of Endor was capable of doing. It was extremely worrying that a very senior elder had been living in California, and he'd been totally unaware of her presence. He thought he knew the locations of most of the important elders and human immortals in the world. Dee wondered if it was significant that he had not been able to contact the Morrigan throughout the day. He'd phoned her with persistent regularity on the drive down, but she wasn't answering her cell. She was either on eBay or playing one of the interminable online strategy games she was addicted to. He didn't know where Bastet was and didn't care. She frightened him, and Dee tended to destroy those people who scared him. Flamel, Skatok, and the twins could be anywhere in the town. But where? Dee allowed a little energy to trickle into his aura. He blinked as his eyes blurred with sudden tears and blinked again to clear them. Suddenly, the people in the car next to his, those crossing the road, and the pedestrians on the sidewalk were outlined in shifting, multicolored auras. Some auras were just wisps of diaphanous tinted smoke. Others were dark spots and sheets of solid, muddy colors. In the end, he found them entirely by chance. He was driving down Ojai Avenue and had gone past Libby Park when he spotted the black Hummer parked on Fox Street. He pulled in behind it and parked.
The moment he got out of his car, he caught the merest hint of a pure gold aura coming from the park, close to the fountain. Dee's thin lips curled in a humorless smile. They would not escape this time. Josh Newman sat by the long, low fountain in Libby Park, directly across from the antiques shop, and stared into the water. Two flower-shaped bowls, one larger than the other, were set in the center of a circular pool. Water spouted from the top bowl and flowed over the sides into the larger bowl beneath. This, in turn, overflowed into the pool. The sound helped drown out the nearby traffic noises. He felt alone and more than a little lost. When the witch had made him leave the antiques shop, he'd walked beneath a shaded promenade and stopped in front of the ice cream shop, lured there by the odors of chocolate and vanilla. He stood outside, reading the menu of exotic flavors, and wondered why his sister's aura smelled of vanilla ice cream and his of oranges. She didn't even really like ice cream. He was the one who loved it. His finger tapped the menu. Blueberry chocolate chip. Josh shoved his hand in the back pocket of his jeans and felt a rising moment of panic as he realized his wallet was missing. He had left it in the car, had he? He stopped. He knew exactly where he'd left it. The last place he'd seen his wallet, along with his dead cell, his iPod, and his laptop, was on the floor next to his bed in his room in the Yggdrasil. Losing his wallet was bad enough, but losing his computer was a disaster. All his emails were on it, along with his class notes, a partially written summer honors project, 3 years of photos, including the trip to Cancun at Christmas, and at least 60 gigs of MP3s. He couldn't remember the last time he had backed up, but it definitely wasn't recently. He actually felt physically ill, and suddenly the odors from the ice cream parlor didn't smell so sweet and enticing. Thoroughly miserable, he walked to the corner and crossed at the lights facing the post office, then turned left, heading toward the park. The iPod had been a Christmas present from his parents. How was he going to explain to them that he'd lost it? Plus, there was close to another 30 gigs of music on the little hard drive. But worse than losing his iPod, his wallet, or even his computer, was losing his phone. That was a total nightmare. All his friends' numbers were on it, and he knew he hadn't written them down anywhere. Because their parents traveled so much, the twins were rarely more than one or two semesters at the same school. They made friends easily, especially Sophie, and they were still in touch with friends they'd met years earlier in schools scattered across America. Without those email addresses and phone numbers, how was he supposed to get in touch with them? How would he ever find them again? There was a water fountain in a little nook before the entrance to the park, and he bent his head to drink. An ornamental metal lion's head was set into the wall over the fountain, and below it there was a small rectangular plaque with the words, "Love is the water of life. Drink deeply." He let the icy water splash over his lips and straightened to look over at the shop, wondering what was happening inside. He still loved his sister, but did she love him? Could she love him now that he was ordinary? Libby Park was quiet. Josh could hear children racing around the nearby playground, but their voices sounded high and very distant. A trio of old men, identically dressed in sleeveless shirts, long shorts, white socks, and sandals, gathered on a shady bench. One of the men was feeding breadcrumbs to a quartet of fat and lazy pigeons. Josh sat down on the edge of the low fountain and leaned over to trail his hand in the water. After the oppressive heat, it felt deliciously cool, and he ran his wet fingers through his hair, feeling water droplets roll down his neck. What was he going to do? Was there anything he could do? In just over 24 hours, his life, and his sister's life too, had changed utterly and incomprehensibly. What he had once believed to be merely stories now turned out to be versions of the truth. Myths had become history. Legends had become facts. When Scatty had revealed earlier that the mysterious Danu Talus was also called Atlantis, he had almost laughed in her face. To him, Atlantis had always been a fairy tale. But if Skatok and Hecate and the Morrigan and Bastet were real, then so was Danu Talis.
and so his parents' life work, archaeology, was suddenly worthless. Josh knew deep down that he had also lost his twin, the constant in his life, the one person he could always count on. She had changed in ways he could not even begin to comprehend. Why hadn't he been awakened too? He should have insisted that Hecate awaken him first. What would it be like to have those powers? The only thing he could compare it to was being a superhero. Even when Sophie's newly awakened senses were making her sick, he was jealous of her abilities. From the corner of his eye, Josh became aware that a man had sat down on one of the other edges of the fountain, but he ignored him. He absently picked at a broken fragment of one of the blue tiles that ran around the fountain. What was he going to do? And the answer was always the same. What could he do? Are you a victim too? It took him a moment before he realized that the figure sitting to his right was talking to him. He started to stand up, the golden rule with creeps being that you never responded and you never, ever entered into any conversation with them. It seems we are all victims of Nicholas Flamel. Startled, Josh looked up and found he was staring at Dr. John Dee, the man he'd hoped never to see again. The last time he'd seen Dee had been in the Shadow Realm. Then he'd held the sword Excalibur in his hands. Now he sat facing him, looking out of place in his impeccably tailored gray suit. Josh looked around quickly, expecting to see golems or rats or even the Morrigan lurking in the shadows.
I am alone, Dee said pleasantly, smiling politely.
Josh's mind was racing. He needed to get to Flamel. He needed to warn him that Dee was an Ojai. He wondered what would happen if he simply got up and ran. Would Dee try to stop him with magic in front of all these people? Josh looked over at the three old men again.